Welcome, everybody, to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee meeting for this July 18th. And it's great to see everybody after about a month and a half hiatus. And we're going to do a series of interim meetings on issues that maybe we didn't have enough time or capacity to do during the regular session. And so really first on our list was an overview of operations and systems here at the airport. Normally we have an overview of the MAC and as part of our agency series of overviews, but you know, we didn't even do those to the extent that we normally do those. So this is one we want to do, and as you know, we don't necessarily fund directly the MAC, but it is an integral part of our transportation system. So what we're going to do is, since this is an interim meeting, we'll just very quickly go around, introduce themselves, and we also have a special legislative guest here as well, and then we'll get started with our agenda. And I'll just say, just in closing, that I was up in Duluth yesterday, and you really get a sense when you're there and when you're here at the airport how critical ports are in our transportation infrastructure. And, you know, up in Duluth, you know, it's a staggering percentage of goods and services that go through that port. And I think we're going to learn today that it's the economic impact of this airport is also staggering. And so it's a very critical part of our transportation infrastructure, and I'm glad we have an opportunity to hear more about it. So with that, why don't we do a very quick round of introductions? And,
I'm Kevin Petrie, Committee Legislative Assistant of the committee.
I'm Jennifer Nelson. I'm the DFL researcher for this committee.
Tammy Lee, House Fiscal Staff.
Representative Matt Norris. I represent Blaine and Lexington, including the Blaine Airport.
Representative Jeff Brand, I represent Nicollet County, some of Blue Earth and some of Le Sueur County.
Morning, everybody. Brent Tedd, Vice Chair of Transportation, and sorry for running late.
That's okay. Frank Hornstein from Minneapolis.
Ines Weigert, City of Transportation.
Matt Burris of House Research.
Joe Marble, GOP Research.
John Petersburg, I represent O'Donnell and Waseca.
Representative Steve Elkins, I represent the western half of Wilmington.
Representative Liz Ryer, Egan and Burnsville, a guest today. Thank you.
Representative Tom Murphy, I represent a little bit of Ottertail County, I guess about two-thirds of Ottertail County and part of Douglas County.
Shane Hidal, I represent Hastings and Cottage Grove.
Thank you, everyone, and we'll proceed. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ricks, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Brian Ricks, Executive Director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and thank you, Chair Hornstein, and committee members for coming out. We always like to have you out here, and I tell people this is the boring part of the day. If you're going to stay for the tour, Mitch gives you a great insight behind the scenes, which I'm sure you'll enjoy, those of you that attend that. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the Airports Commission. I'll talk a little bit about COVID recovery, air service, some of the infrastructure investments that we're making, the major ones that we're making, and then a little bit about customer experience that we, frankly, pride ourselves in at this facility. I'm not sure this doesn't seem to be working. There we go. Why don't you just go ahead and advance for me? Go ahead and advance to the next one. First of all, go ahead, Chris. You can advance to the next one. A little bit about the Airports Commission. In Minneapolis, we are the 16th largest commercial airport in North America. As you know, we're Delta's second largest hub. We're a home base and a hub for Sun Country Airlines. We had just over 31 million passengers go through the facility in 2022. and about 652,000 system-wide operations. So very busy airport system with Minneapolis and the six reliever airports. To give you a little perspective, of that 652,000 operations, about 48% were at Minneapolis. The rest were spread through our reliever system, Flying Cloud and Anoka being our busiest two reliever airports. Next slide. This is our commission led by Chair Rick King. We have Commissioner Ginsburg here in the audience as well. I think you know the majority of them are appointed by the governor, with the exceptions of the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Each have an appointee. But this commission has been pretty stable over the last few years. I don't believe there were no new appointments from the governor. So they are really focused on the business of the airport. The commission was established back in 1943. And I always say, you think back to the governor and the legislature at that time and taking the initiative to really appoint a commission responsible for focusing on what is in the best interest of the business of the airport and creating an airport system that frankly works extremely well in this region. Next slide. At the end of last year, we went through a completely new enterprise strategic planning process. We got rid of our previous vision and mission, and we came up with a new purpose. And this is our purpose, to provide exceptional airport experiences so Minnesota thrives. And I think this purpose, along with our values and the goals that have been established, first of all, the timing was great, coming off the most catastrophic event that has impacted aviation in my lifetime, and also really looking for how we position this airport the best we can so that it impacts the entire state in a positive way. So this is our new purpose statement, along with values and goals for moving forward with really moving this facility to the next level. Go ahead, Chris. We operate similar to a city with one exception. We don't take in any tax revenue. The revenues that are generated here are based on user fees, but we have our own police, we have our own fire, we have dispatch, we have building inspection, and all the aspects to really make this facility operate at the highest level possible, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. You can see we have 754 employees. That's what we hope to have soon. During COVID, we were in a phase where we really were not hiring as positions came available or came up. We only hired if they were absolutely mission critical. We were down by about 100 employees during COVID. It got to a point where your employees can only take that much stress for so long. And at the end of 2022, we actually started hiring again. But right now, we're at 677 employees, so we are in a hiring mode to really boost our employees back up and grow the number to ensure that we are operating as best we can, have the resources that we need to operate. Next slide. The chair talked a little bit about the economic impact. This study, I'll admit, is a little old. It was done in 2017. And 2017 indicated that this airport has about a $16 billion overall economic impact on the region. It affects about 86,000 jobs. There's about 20,000 jobs that work out on the site each day. Generates close to $1 billion in local, state, and federal taxes, and there's about a $2.5 billion visitor impact coming through this facility. Go ahead, Chris. We'll talk a little bit about the COVID impacts. You can next slide. Obviously, the airport and hospitality industries were hit very hard by COVID. Between 2020 and 2022, about $40 billion worth of losses. I'll talk a little bit more how that impacted us. Globally, airports lost about $82 billion. And in 2021, 2022, about another $61 billion. Next slide. This really shows our low point. And that low point was April of 2020 when our numbers dropped 95%. What you see here is this is our boardings, our employments as we refer to them. You can see the climb back. And, you know, it varied based on time of year, how much leisure travel is occurring. Business travel in our region took longer to recover. But you can see in 2023, we're back to about 11.5% reduction. When you look at the first 5 months of this year, we're about 13.4% down from the 2019, the record 2019 levels that we had out here. Next slide. As far as nonstop routes, we came into COVID on the left-hand side of the screen, there were 213 nonstop routes. We dropped to 91 again in May of 2020. And then we slowly climbed back. The good news is we are now at more nonstop routes than we had pre-COVID, 224. The other line on the bottom reflects suspended routes. And when you look at those 15, at this point, the only suspended route we still have is Dublin. The other routes are really a result of airlines phasing out the smaller 50-seat aircraft and not serving some communities any longer. So whether we'll see those 15 routes come back is a big question mark right now. But the positive side, we've grown to beyond what we've seen. And just to give you a stat on those smaller jets that used those 50-seat regional jets, we used to have 206 regional jets operating every day, 206 departures every day. That number has been cut in half to about 105 right now. So big impact when you look at those smaller aircraft. Next slide, Chris. So financially, when we look at our operating revenue, as I said, we generate revenue. It's based on user fees. You know, if you operate at the airport or you do business at the airport, we collect revenue from you to support that operation or the operation of the facility and the investment in infrastructure. We saw during COVID, the left bars show that we had about $406 million in revenue and, you know, just below $250 million in expense prior to COVID. You can see what happened to our revenue numbers the year after. That dropped to about $250 million. So we lost about $150 million that first year. We were able to do whatever we could to reduce expenditures. I think we were able to pull about $23 million out of our expenditures. But the challenge with that, with a facility like this, is you still have to maintain the asset. And there's so much infrastructure out there, whether or not people are, you know, some areas, terminal facilities, you can close and shutter off a little bit, but the airfield, you have to keep it open and you have to maintain the lights. You have to plow the snow. So it was difficult to reduce operating expenditures. You can see in 2021, we were able to gain about another $100 million in revenues as things slowly came back. And this year, we're actually going to exceed that revenue number. We're forecasting about $447 million in revenues here, just on the other side of just over $250 million in expenditures. So big changes and big impacts to our operating budget. This gives you a little sense of parking. Again, I like to show this. It's a busy slide, but I like to show it because it really gives you the sense of the impact. We typically generate about $300,000 a day in parking. It's just an average, up to $10 million a month. And when you look at April of 2020, we generated $278,000 that entire month. So that tells you the impact and how important the user fees and revenues coming from people using the facility are. Good news is we've climbed back and we're getting very close to the 2019 levels. Next slide, Chris. This gives you a little sense of our capital improvement program investment. And again, I mentioned $300 million we lost in revenues during those 2 years, two to three years during COVID. Another $300 million was deferred in capital investment in 2020. We went into 2020 expecting to spend about $400 million in projects. We had to pull that back immediately. We just didn't have the dollars to support it. And we pulled it back to about $250 million. So we pulled $150 million out. In 2021, we pulled another $150 million out. So we're in a mode now where we're trying to catch up. And that's been, that will be the one of our biggest challenges as we move forward. You can see we are looking at over $1 billion in infrastructure investment in 2024. And when you look at the next 3 years, it's approaching $2 billion in infrastructure investment. So a lot of projects, a lot going on. Part of that is we issue bonds to support that. One of the concerns that we do have is there going to be enough workforce out in the construction industry to support that investment? When you look at everything else that's going on in the state with MnDOT, we actually had a runway construction project that we bid out earlier this year. We had no bids on it, which was the first time in history that has ever occurred. And so that is concerning to us. Next slide, Chris. I'll move into air service a little bit and talk a little bit about where things are globally. First of all, traffic rebounded in 2023 to about 89% of 2019. North America, that number is up to about 98% when you look at domestic traffic. As we all know, the leisure travel came back and is exceeding levels back in 2019, so that is moving forward pretty well. As I said, our first 5 months we're down about 13.4%. Most of that is the result of Delta Airlines still is not at pre-COVID capacity. They still are about 10% down system wide. If you recall, last year in June, July, the airlines were having a lot of issues, and a lot of those issues relative to staffing shortages, not enough crews, not enough flight attendants, not enough gate staff. And the CEO of Delta, Ed Bastian, came out and said, we are not performing at a level that we should be performing at. As a result, we're going to pull the operation back. They slowly moved that up, but there's still about a 10% reduction in capacity. And as one of Delta's hubs, that's what we're seeing and feeling. Next slide. The good news is we've seen 26 new routes, primarily by Sun Country and Delta Airlines in 2023. The nice announcement domestically is they've added now a nonstop flight to Maui in addition to the Honolulu flight. That will commence on December 16th and run through March of next year. Sun Country also, as you've probably seen and heard, is doing a tremendous amount of growth. Jude Bricker, the new CEO of Sun Country, has transitioned that airline from a low-cost carrier to an ultra-low-cost carrier. But the model is working, and it works well for this region. Originally, their focus when Jude took over was going to grow outside of Minneapolis. That focus turned back to Minneapolis shortly, about 6 months later, when they realized how well of a performing market the Twin Cities is. So we'll continue to see growth from Sun Country moving forward. Next slide. A little bit about international, and the good news on international is we have recovered all of our international service with one exception, as I mentioned before, and that's Dublin. We're working hard on getting Dublin back. I'm hopeful We'll see that service back hopefully in 2024. The Asia Pacific service to Incheon and Haneda came back, which was excellent news. The European traffic came back sooner. We've added some Canadian service to on Air Canada, and now WestJet has started service to Edmonton and Saskatoon, which are two pretty good business markets for the Twin Cities region. Iceland Air has come back. Iceland Air celebrated their 25th anniversary in Minneapolis not too long ago. Condor to Frankfurt, KLM. Sun Country has expanded internationally as well to some of those southern destinations. So pretty good results on the international front. Talk a little bit about reliever airports. I think I just have a couple of slides to give you a trend here. Reliever airports actually performed pretty well during COVID, with the exception of St. Paul Downtown Airport. St. Paul Downtown Airport has a lot of corporate companies with corporate traffic. That one was a little slower to recover, but again, system-wide, we're doing well at our reliever airports. There's a lot of people that are flying. There's a lot of corporate activity that has come back. There's a lot of flight training. Next slide, Chris. This gives you a little sense of some of the things that have happened at the reliever airports. We opened a new runway at Lake Elmo Airport. That runway was realigned and extended slightly to improve the safety of that operation. We're in the midst of over 700 lease renewals through the facility. We've added 20 new hangars across the system. There's a new FBO up in Blaine that is performing well. And I guess this last bullet says flood wall mobilization. We did put the flood wall up at St. Paul first time since 2019. We didn't have to build that wall quite as high as its capability is. So that was good news. But that flood wall really helps eliminate the disruption for those businesses and that traffic coming into St. Paul. I'll move into infrastructure investments a little bit now. I want to start by talking a little bit about Terminal 1. And I show this slide because what I should do is show a slide of the terminal back when it was built in the 60s out in the middle of a field with ground parking and nothing else around it. But I think what's been phenomenal at this airport is how these facilities have been able to transform to keep up with the changing of the times and the increased demand that has happened over the last 50 or 60 years. What we started doing back in 2016 was a program we called Operational Enhancements or Improvements, our OI program. And what that did is it added 15 feet to the front of this terminal facility. We pushed it out. We had a little space between the sidewalk and the roadway. And we completely redeveloped our ticketing area, our baggage claim area, and all of our vertical circulation at the facility. And you can go to the next slide. It's been about a $450 million project. It's been phased over 7 years now, about 7 years. And again, it has completely transformed the facility. We have that extra space was vital during COVID when we had social distancing. We've raised the ceiling on the baggage claim area, the area you see on the right, which really helped improve just the environment down there, added all LED lighting throughout the facility. That glass you see up on the left, if you look closely the next time you're in the facility, what you'll see is etchings of Minnesota lakes, all the contours of the Minnesota lakes. The southern state lakes are on the south end of the facility. The central Minnesota lakes are in the center. And on the north end are the northern Minnesota lakes. We feel that really brings a sense of place into this airport. So take a look at that. We're very proud of the work that has been accomplished. It will be complete here in the next year and a half. So we're looking forward to that project being done. And because you have to phase it, the amount of traffic coming through, you have to phase it in multiple phases. phases. We were able to speed up some things during COVID, but a great project that I think we can all be proud of. Next slide. Another area that we've been working on is Concourse G, the Concourse G expansion, and a new Delta Sky Club. Those areas have now opened. They opened, the Sky Club opened about 3 months ago. But what we're doing at Concourse G has a lot of larger Delta aircraft on it. It was not designed to support that size aircraft. If you recall, and there's still some areas, you go down a small, not very wide corridor, and then bumps out into gate areas with restrooms that frankly are inadequate, seating areas that are inadequate, concessions that are inadequate. What we've done is we've expanded the area between those bump outs, between gate 17 and 2022, added more seating, more concessions, larger restrooms, and then above that area created a central corridor and a new, we shelled out a Delta Sky Club. Delta came in and then finished the Sky Club. It's the third Delta Sky Club. It was desperately needed. If you've been there and you've seen the lines waiting in to get into the existing Sky Clubs, it's positioned in a wonderful location, it's really a class facility. That Sky Club is a no-waste facility as well. So there's no waste generated from that facility. Everything was done in a sustainable fashion, and it's a fantastic signature Sky Club. Next slide. This gives you a little sense of what it looks like going down the concourse and the new finishes, the terrazzo, the art, the culture, some of the concessions on the left. Picture on the right kind of shows or depicts what I was explaining is that's the old concourse. As you go down, you can see the bump out in that picture there. So we are pushing the concourse to the south and adding all of that additional space in there. And it's transforming the environment. The other thing that we're going to be doing is investing about $230 million in all of the other concourses over the next 3 to 5 years to make them look similar to what you're seeing here. So we've done the front of the house. When you do the front of the house, it makes the other stuff not look quite as good. And so these investments will really make the experience consistent from curb to gate. Next slide. This is another big project that we have going on. It's building a new aircraft rescue and firefighting station to replace the firefighting station that was built in the 1960s. We have two stations on the airport. This will replace the older one. And then what we'll be doing in the coming years is combining all of our emergency operations and our safety and security elements into one facility. Right now, they are scattered all over the place. We need this to help support major incidents that can occur at this facility. It's a big project. It's in excess of $100 million. The fire station is about a $43 million project. We're gaining some pretty good federal grant dollars for the fire station. It is a facility that is well needed throughout the facility. Next slide. We're also looking at adding a couple of gates to Terminal 2, and that's just the first phase. We desperately need gates at Terminal 2 to support the growth that Sun Country is experiencing. And these two gates will begin to be constructed next year. They're on the right. They're kind of in the middle of the slide there. You can see the two additional gates that expand the building out a little bit further. So that's a very important project as well. Next slide. And then we are also just in a public comment period for our MSP long-term comprehensive plan that really takes us out to 2040. This is a long list of projects that we've identified in that comprehensive plan. I'll talk about a few here. You see number 7 is expanding those two gates on the north there where those two aircraft are. The ultimate plan is to then go south. You see number 1 Those are gates that wrap around to the south and east to support. I think that adds another 11 gates down to the south. And then eventually, if we need it, we'll go wrap back to the north and east where the current FBO, Signature Aviation, is located. In order to do that, we'll relocate Signature Aviation to the north side of the field where number six is. But that is the plan for Terminal 2. As far as Terminal 1 goes, our plan is to straighten out concourses E and F. Right now, they kind of go out at a funny angle. And what that does is it limits the ability of aircraft to taxi, parallel taxi between that concourse, and it makes it not as efficient as it needs to be. So we'll straighten those concourses out. There's the ability to add additional gates on the east side of Concourse G as well, where number 10 is. We're looking at some additional parking locations for aircraft that remain overnight here on the field. Sun Country has a big need in that regard. We're looking at a taxiway, number 12 at the top, that can get around the south parallel runway there. And so a lot of improvements will be required over the years. When you look at the gates down there, that little chart on the bottom of the screen, you'll see T1 starts with 102 gates. It actually goes down to 95. The reason for that is we have a lot of those small regional jet aircraft gates on Concourse A and B right now. Delta wants us to upgrade those to larger aircraft gates. When you do that, you can't get as many gates in because they're larger aircraft, but that's why that number actually decreases at Terminal 1, and then you'll see a big increase, the ability to bring 35 new gates to Terminal 2. So the net result is an additional 12 gates. Next slide. A little bit about sustainability. We adopted a 2030 goals a couple of years ago. Brought those a new sustainability goals to the commission and a new sustainability plan to our commission that calls for an 80% reduction in emissions, 75% waste diversion reduction, 15% reduction of water, and engagement score of 85 by 2030. So we are working under that currently. And if you go to the next slide, Chris, we have made some nice advancements in some of our initiatives. Diversion is a big deal for us. We are partnering with Loaves and Fishes, and in 2022 recovered 27 tons of food for donations to those that need meals. And what happens, you have food at the airport prepared every day that doesn't get used, and it goes to support this this program. In 2022, our solar panels up on Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 generated enough electricity to power 550 homes for 1 year. And in 2022, also by going through and changing fixtures and adding devices on our restrooms, we saved 19 million gallons of water, enough to fill 29 Olympic swimming pools. So we're pretty proud of those. That effort will continue, through everything that we're doing out here, but we're pretty proud of some of the progress that we've made already. Talk a little bit about what we're doing to support the travel experience. We started tracking security wait times back in 2018, 2019. We partnered with a company called Zovis that actually put devices in the ceiling of our terminal facilities so that we can see where people are, how long queue lines are, so that we can identify areas that we need to address or move people around or from one end of the facility to another to support the efficient flow of passengers through the facility. That is great, but it's also dependent upon how many staff that TSA has. And that is probably our biggest challenge. TSA continues to be down, 60 or 70 security screening officers. They typically have about 670 screening officers here between the two terminals. And if you see your state or your federal counterparts, that it always helps us to say TSA needs more staff here. They're doing everything they can. So that's how we track security wait times. Next slide. We also started a pre-book parking program where individuals can pre-book their parking. That's at a discounted rate, and that has certainly generated additional revenue and opportunities and flexibility for individuals to ensure that they have a parking location when they come to this facility. Really important for the folks coming from outside the Twin Cities region. As part of that program, we're developing a customer relations management tool that really identifies how often individuals travel. Is it business? Is it leisure? What their interests are? We're building this database so that we can do whatever we can from planning on when we need more people at the front of the house to get individuals through the facility, where concessions should be located, products are available at certain times of the day based on whether it's an international or domestic traveler. So we're building this database that is exciting for us as we get to know who our passengers are and what they desire. Next slide, Chris. The other thing that we're piloting, this is fairly new. We started in, I believe it was May of this year, is a virtual queuing program called MSP Reserve, where if you're flying out of T2, you can actually call up and reserve a time to get through TSA security screening. This is a program that has been implemented at some other airports, and the results thus far are very good. This is all about trying to shave off those real high peaks where things get very backed up. And if you can shave those peaks off by about 10%, it can make a world of difference. As a traveler, if you know you can show up at a certain time and you're not going to be waiting, you know, for 20, 30 minutes in a security line and get through screening, that is a much more comforting feeling than just showing up and seeing a long line in front of you. So this is an exciting program that we would expect we would implement also at T1. A little bit about commitment to excellence, and then I think I'm done here. Go ahead, Chris. Next slide. Customer service is foundational for us, and will continue to be foundational. I view our facilities as hospitality facilities for our customers, and it starts with a customer service action council that we've had going on out here, where we get together with all of our stakeholders and talk about what we can do to improve. If we receive complaints, we send those to the stakeholder and we hold them accountable to address those complaints, whether it's us or whether it's one of our business partners. So this is a very important, we focused a lot on accessibility. The accessibility started with starting a committee called our Travelers with Disabilities Advisory Committee, where they bring ideas and information to us that we can implement into our capital improvement programs. It's results oriented. We partnered with Delta to get this mock aircraft to help people that have concerns about flying, to run them through what processes they will go through. We also have a program called Navigating MSP that started with helping children, autistic children, come out to the airport and experience what they're going to go through. And it has been just a wonderful, wonderful program. We've adopted IRA, which allows those that have sight issues to put on some glasses and talk to someone live that helps them navigate through the facility. We have a program called Sunflower Lanyard that if a person wants to wear a lanyard, it identifies that they may have special needs as they're going through our facilities. Hearing loops were established here many years ago as well. So a lot of focus on accessibility. Next slide. In fact, we received a brand new accreditation this year. It's the highest accreditation available through Airports Council International on our sustainability efforts. I was asked to come testify to the House Aviation Committee in D.C. late last year on those efforts that we are making. So we're very, very proud of them. Next slide. I don't brag, but these are some great awards that are really focused on the employees that we have at our facilities. Our concessions employees, our workers do great work. We were honored with J.D. Power's highest ranking for mega airports last year, and also received Best Airport North America Award for 25 to 40 million passengers from Airports Council International, the sixth time we've won it in the last 7 years. That is it for today. I'm happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you for an on-time arrival. We exactly how much we have. and we didn't pad the schedule. So we've set aside about a half hour or so for member Q&A here. We can go a little bit longer. Members have a lot of questions. So, right, we'll start with Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rakes, for that presentation. Earlier on, when you talked about finances, I just had a quick question. It looked like the slide in regards to revenue versus expenses, for a lot of those, the distance between those two were quite large. Am I correct in understanding that the expenses you're talking about was just operational expenses, and that the difference is really what's available for infrastructure and expansion programs that you need to maintain? Is that kind of the correct analysis there?
Chair and Representative Director Petersburg, yes, that is correct. What I didn't tell you when you look at that slide, so that's a good observation, is that we have a debt service payment through bonds that we issue to support infrastructure that is about $115 million annually. So when you look at that, that brings that down, gap down quite a bit. And that was our challenge during COVID, especially. And we did get some federal relief, thanks to the good work that Mitch did out in D.C. along with our trade organizations. I think we received about $295 million in federal relief during that time. $64 million of that went to support was passed through to our airlines and concessionaires. So, but when you look at that $115 million annual debt service payment, that's primarily what we use that relief is to ensure that we could survive through that time. But that's you're right, that's the difference.
Was it
Petersburg? No, I thought that was the case, but I want to clarify it. For a lot of us, we would assume that the cost of everything would be included in the expenses, and I wanted to make that distinction that I think it was just operating expenses that you're referring to and not overall expenses of the airports.
Exactly. And next up, Representative Elkins, an aviation professional as well, in the previous life. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So a redevelopment in the South Loop area in Bloomington is proceeding pretty rapidly right now, to the point where I know the City Council is considering not renewing the conditional use permits for Park and Fly and Park and Go. Do you think the airport has enough available parking capacity to absorb those losses when that happens?
Chair Hornstein and Representative Elkins, we do. We believe, I think the percentage of those parkers, we think there's other parking programs, as you probably know, out there with hotels and with the TNC options and all of that. We don't believe we will receive all of that, but we've looked at that very closely and we feel confident that we can. The Silver Ramp, the new addition of the Silver Ramp, which added a whole new ground transportation facility to support some of the larger buses and the limos and all of that, also added about 3,400 parking locations. So we feel pretty comfortable that we can support it on a daily basis. When we get into peak times, that probably will be a little bit more challenging as we move forward. But we do have capacity at Terminal 2 as well, so that's always an option.
Hello. Okay. Representative Fidella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think the lag in business travel still is tied to COVID and just more people still working from home and teams and more use of digital media instead of flying somewhere to meet?
Chair Holstein, Representative Nicola, I do. I think that's the, as we were going through COVID, I think that was the big question. What will be the long-term impact of COVID and virtual meetings and travel long-term? And so I think that's still at play. What we did see here in the Twin Cities when we would go down and visit with Delta at their headquarters and talk about demand, they saw this region was responding slower than other regions. Obviously, destination markets, because of the leisure traffic, came back very, very quickly, but our business market seemed to come back much slower than other areas of the country. So that will be an impact. I think that the big question is how much of an impact. Will it be 5% of what travel used to be? Will it be somewhere between 5% and 10%? But it'll be interesting to see that. You know, what we've seen thus far is the leisure traffic kind of offsetting that. What we, I think, learned through COVID is that people have a desire to travel. They're always going to have a desire to travel and have a desire for that personal interaction, whether it's leisure or business. I can guarantee you that if your competitor in business is going out and visiting with a client, you're probably going to do the same thing. But there's a percentage that has been taken away through the improvements that have been made. Virtual meeting spaces.
Paula? Thank you, Representative Goodell. Representative Tapp, Vice Chair Tapp.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ricks, first I wanted to just say thank you very much for your work on transit safety, specifically light rail safety. You were an early and extremely helpful proponent of helping to get other folks on board and the work that he was doing on light rail safety. So thank you very much for that. I wish, and your work committed to that continuing. The MAC has been significantly more impactful and helpful than many other entities. So we'll get into that at a later transportation hearing committee. I just appreciate your work there. And then secondly, just want to see where what your observations are currently as to there's been overwhelming reporting from everybody and myself from riding transportation that things feel like they're getting better and ridership is increasing, and just seeing where what observations you're seeing here, whether that's consistent or not consistent with what's happening.
That's right. Vice Chair Tapke, thank you for the question and thank you for the interest on this topic. We obviously, along with many others, are very concerned about this issue for our employees and for the passengers that rely on this light rail to get from here to the mall or to Minneapolis or St. Paul or wherever they're heading. So you're right, we've invested, we are very concerned about it. We've been concerned for a while. I want to give our Chair Rick Kane credit for this has probably been his top issue and initiative in working with folks at Met Council, Governor's office to address it. We're seeing an improvement right now, but I hesitate to say how much of an improvement that is because of the weather versus what's really going on. I personally took it a couple of months ago, and between Terminal 1 and Terminal 2, and the help line probably saw about a dozen individuals that probably shouldn't have been on it. But we had officers, the Metropolitan Airports Commission had officers through a arrangement with Met Council riding the train and trying to ensure that people felt safe that were there. When I came back from my trip, I rode back and Met Council had officers on the train doing the same thing. So we're working hard. The challenge for us, just like everybody else, is we are very concerned about Met Council's ability to hire officers and be able to support it. We're technically responsible for the platforms. We're not supposed to be on the trains. We're happy to do that now, but my police chief says, you know, we don't expect this to be a long-term solution. We need Met Council and others to really pitch in, and I think that's what a challenge is. So it's improved from what it was, but what my police chief told me just last week was he thinks people are getting off before they get here because the officer presence that we have. So it may be pushing the issue. Well, some of it's related to the time of year as well, the improvements that we're seeing right now. But I think there's a follow-up meeting we've asked for in the coming month to really start thinking about as we move into the colder weather season and to try to stay ahead of it as much as we can. Thank you for that.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rich, for the presentation. I thought it was great. I just want to let you know that your number one ranking doesn't go unnoticed. My kids brought it up to me one time and said, you know, this is the number one rated airport in the U.S. And as we drove in, it was like, geez, this is really nice and simple. And I just flew this last week, and there's a lot of stuff going on just to keep everything organized during all that is pretty impressive. So hats off for that. My question is about TSA and PreCheck. Maybe it's more of a TSA question, but what percentage of travelers use those tools?
Sure. Chair Martin, Representative Murphy. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll get it. And I'm trying to recall if it's there's so many different programs out there.
There's Clear.
Right. There's PreCheck. Delta has separate lanes for their premium passengers, whether it's first class or so. Well, I'll get you an answer on that. I want to say 10 to 15%, but Mitch will make a note of that, and we'll get you the answer on that. I mean, obviously, I've been a part of PreCheck for a long time. I don't have Clear, but typically it works. It's very rare if you PreCheck that you have a long line. Now, I did witness one when I came to the facility a couple of weeks ago, but it's become more and more popular. So I encourage everyone between PreCheck, Global Entry, if you do a lot of international travel, it's the way to go. Sorry, I couldn't answer your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I PreCheck, and I just every time I go there, I think, God, I just can't believe more people aren't doing this. You know, and I'm not sure what all goes into it on your side, but it certainly is a benefit for moving people through a more streamlined, and that's really appreciated. So, thank you.
Okay, one more?
Nope.
Okay. Any other member questions? You have one?
It's just a comment where I'm enrolled in Global Entry, which gives me access to PreCheck as well. And I just got back from an international trip and cleared customs here in Minneapolis with Global Entry. And it was incredibly smooth experience. It was through like no line at all. So it's working out really well.
Good.
It's great to hear.
Great. I have a couple, but I want to make sure that the all the members who had questions have already asked them. Any other questions? Okay, well, I have a couple. So first, number one, thank you for the presentation and your hospitality today. Very much appreciated. On the sustainability question, I know there's several of us around the table that have constituents and communities that are impacted by noise. We have Egan at the table, we have Bloomington, Minneapolis, and I don't know if there's issues in the Lane Airport or not. But,
occasionally, some of the private jets flying overhead.
Yeah. So what's the latest? I know there's a NOC committee that you have. There's been, of course, a lot of work over many, many years in Minneapolis. We have the whole public engagement with the RNAV program a number of years ago. When I see the long-term plan that you put forward, you know, and I see expansion, more gates, et cetera. So that's more planes, more noise. What is the, how is noise mitigation incorporated into your planning process, and sort of what's the status of those conversations? I think with Olson's here, we talk about this from time to time with Minneapolis. So any just sort of noise 101 for the committee?
Sure, Chair Hornstein, thank you for the question. Lauren, thank you for being here as well. We're actually celebrating NACS, and NACS stands for those that don't know it, the Noise Oversight Committee, their 20th anniversary. And this is an excellent, excellent group made up of representatives put in by communities and representatives from the industry that get together once a month and talk about what the concerns and what the issues are. So NAC is in a very good state. The participation is strong. They've been briefed on the long-term comprehensive plan. We had a meeting just over in Minneapolis last week, as a matter of fact, to go through the details of that. I had very few comments relative to concerns. I mean, some individuals that spoke were concerned about noise, obviously. What I'll say is the MAC has invested more than any other airport in noise mitigation around all around this facility, and that number is over, I think it's going to be pushing $600 million here. So we're continuing to be committed to it. We watch our contours very closely to see what's happening. We've amended our consent decree last year, the year before, that gives us the ability to continue to add noise mitigation to the homes within the 60 LDN contour, which goes beyond what the federal requirements are. And so we're committed to it. I think what was presented in the, we present our contours in the long-term comp plan. And I think the good news with the contours and the aircraft operations that make up those contours is we've seen this trend of larger aircraft and less operations since COVID, and we expect that trend to continue. I think at our peak time, we had 508,000 annual operations back in, I'm trying to remember what year that was, 2007, 2008, maybe. We're down to about 400,000 operations. So the forecasts, because of the growth and the size of the aircraft, really don't show a dramatic increase in the number of operations. The other thing that's happening is airlines are continuing to purchase aircraft that are less noisy. I don't say quiet aircraft, I say less noisy aircraft. And that has continued to bring the contours in somewhat. What will drive our contours is nighttime operations, because they're penalized 10 times more. So that's always a concern, but I think NAC is on top of that. We're committed to continuing our engagement process through the noise community, and I think it's in a good place. I really do. Far cry from those meetings when I first was at the MAC in the mid-'80s that had a lot of screaming and yelling going.
There were some raucous meetings.
Yes, there was.
Good. So that seemed to have prompted a couple of questions, Representative Elkins and then Representative Petersburg.
Are the current noise contours published on the website anywhere people can see them?
Chair Hornstein, Representative Elkins, they are. They're on our noise oversight website. So I know Naomi Pesky, who leads our strategy and stakeholder engagement division, is here. She can point you to those if you need to.
Okay.
Representative Elkins.
Chair, what is the current status of the RNAV program? Is it still pretty much on hold, or is it being used in part?
The RNAV program has not moved forward since.
Maybe you can just let the committee know what that stands. I referred to it too and should have explained it. So,
our RNAV is a program where FAA assigns headings on departure that can push aircraft in a specific location or can specific headings that can concentrate aircraft in specific areas that could have a much larger impact on specific areas of the community. So that program, which FAA tried to roll out here a number of years ago, didn't go anywhere. I will tell you this: FAA is looking at decommissioning the FAA or the VOR, which is a navigational device, which allows them to determine headings off of the runways. As part of that decommissioning, they are looking at different ways, and frankly, using some RNAV capability to assign aircraft headings. What we've told them and what NAC has told them is before that were to occur, we want to see what the impact was. And again, it's different from what they were proposing a number of years ago. It's just decommissioning the VOR. So they're going to model that, and they're decommissioning these old VOR navigational devices all over the country. So that's just part of their program. So they will bring that modeling back to us and see what it looks like, and we'll determine whether they feel they can operate just like they are today, even if they decommission that VOR. But we're asking them to ensure that they can justify that or determine that for sure.
Mr. Chair, one more kind of follow-up. So when RNAV was first proposed, I recall that it was very difficult to find any information about what the resulting noise contours would have been if it had gone into effect. And I remember that one of the objectives was to concentrate traffic, but concentrate the traffic, especially the departing traffic, over the roadways rather than over homes. And so wondering if as we move forward on these different kinds of new technology concepts, that people will have the ability to see what the noise contours would be, if there are new technology ways to try and keep planes from flying over people's homes instead of roadways.
Sir, it's
Representative Elkins. Yes, I mean that's the key, is to be able to model what the impact is on the contours and all of that. It's the challenge with identifying a roadway and trying to move everyone on that is they really rely on dispersion in order to support the capacity that is operating here. With that, if they were just to focus on a single stream out over a roadway, it would result in, one, people along that roadway being pretty impacted, right? And secondly, probably some pretty significant delay trying to get aircraft off the ground here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I think it's kind of answering some of the questions already, but years ago I was in some committee hearings in which there was discussion over the system about not the FAA determining not only direction of departures but also rate of climb, and that had been implemented somewhat, and there was a lot of concern because that changed where some of that sound is. Are you saying that system has been turned back, or is that system still in place, and is there any issues with that anymore at this time, or has everybody kind of settled down to understanding what was going on?
Sure. Representative Petersburg, so let me just say this, that the way aircraft operate here has not been changed, or is as far as pilots flying aircraft want to get up as quickly as possible. And that there's a lot of factors that are involved in that, whether it's the type of aircraft they're flying, the wind, weather conditions. If there's a stronger wind, the aircraft can get up quicker. But that is in their interest, to get up as quickly as possible. And then also Delta in Sun Country and the airlines typically have procedures where they'll pull back the power a little bit to save fuel and save on the noise. So those procedures continue to go on, along with all of our other noise abatement procedures.
that have been instituted here over the years. In fact, there was just another procedure based on some concerns that we had from Eagan, the Eagan area, that was implemented over the past couple of years.
Thank you.
Thank you. The other member questions? I got still one or two left here. Members? Okay, good. Well, thank you for the update on some noise issues. I wanted to get a little bit of more into the sustainability question. You know, my understanding and what I've checked is these statistics kind of move around a little bit. Presently, you know, aviation accounts for 2% of total greenhouse gas emissions. And I appreciated the goals that you've set for 2030. And I think, like, that comparing yourself to a local government entity, which I think is accurate in many ways. And so a lot of local government, state government, we all have done these resolutions with these goals in mind. And I think that as the climate emergency worsens year by year, I think implementation of those goals are you know, essential. It's good to have that resolution, to have that framework out there. But what are some steps you're taking to make sure that those goals are implemented? 75% waste diversion, percent waste diversion, and some of the others that I saw. We referenced that in our in the legislation this year. Your goals and mm-hmm. something you will be pursuing, or we will be pursuing, you know, during the regular session is an update on progress and some ideas to really enhance your waste management issues in terms of plastics reduction, et cetera. Are some ideas that we have in the bill that have been put forward, but you know, not to just we'll delve into this, I think, in February a little bit more, but. What are some of the ways you're looking at implementing greenhouse gas emissions 2030 goals?
Chair Hornstein, thank you for the question. So I think the first step was defining a program and adopting, going to the commission and adopting that program. When I came here 7 years ago, we didn't have a program at all. And I think through our strategic planning efforts, we really focused on this. And we would build buildings and not really think about LEED certification because of the cost, right? I mean, cost was everything. We've completely changed that mentality where we're thinking about sustainability on anything that we're currently doing. I think it, you know, I showed a slide a little bit about some of the diversion and the water savings and all of that. We're partnering with our airline partners on installing EV infrastructure to support their operation. We're looking at what we can do from an EV standpoint for our entire fleet. Now, some of the challenges with snow removal and aircraft rescue and firefighting equipment is they need to respond very quickly and rapidly, and some of that equipment doesn't perform quite as well in colder climates. So we are looking and watching those elements very very carefully. We've enhanced our comfort settings. We've taken a whole new approach to comfort settings across the board. I talked about the water diversion, the waste diversion with paper towels. And all of that. We are part of Airport Council International's Airport Carbon Accreditation Program, where we've achieved an accreditation 3 level that is really, again, focused on what we can do as an airport. Reality, as you know, is the airlines account for much more the greenhouse gas emissions than right. The airport does. So we're working with Delta on doing all we can. And I don't want to speak on behalf of Delta, but as you know, sustainable aviation fuel is a pretty big priority for them. And the exemption that the legislature adopted to support that this year
is important to them. They want Minneapolis to stand out as an example of a sustainable aviation fuel hub for them. So we're working very closely on those elements as well.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're at time, members. There are obviously many other questions. I have a few left on labor-related issues, but we can get into that next year. I know there was a real effort. I testified along with others several years ago at SEIU with the $15 wage, and we have many low-wage workers here at the airport, and I think it's really important to remember them and work with the MAC on that to make sure that there's fair wages and working conditions. And that's just something I wanted to put out there as well. And I know there's members of the MAC commission that are interested in that and individual commissioners that be continuing that conversation. So members, before we break for now, I do want to acknowledge that our amazing committee administrator, she's going to hate this, but I have to do it. I want to congratulate her because she is admitted to law school, which is no easy feat these days. And it's, I think, a testament to her overall incredibleness. So this is her last meeting, and she'll be moving to the East Coast in early August. So I speak for everyone around this table. I think I speak for people in this room and all of these various transportation stakeholders. I'm thanking you. You are unique in terms of, your skill set, how you've been able to just really relate to all members, all parts of the state. It's extraordinary. And I think everyone around the table appreciates that, and then your ability to work with the public. We had a really challenging session this year, and you helped really administer and run this committee so well under really challenging, very difficult circumstances at times. And diving right into this job as a CA, just absolutely incredible. So I want to, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Congratulate you, wish you well. You have a lot of friends here in the Transportation Committee, and we appreciate you. And many of our sentiments are expressed here. So. Awesome. So, with that, members, we're likely going to have, I think some of us are going to be on the tour. We also are going to have a couple of more interim hearings. I'm working with several members on some topics on those, and those will be in fall. And if others have ideas that they would like to have us be in the interim, I'm open to that. Not too many, but I could see several more of these, and really getting out of the state capitol as well. Greater Minnesota post some ideas on topics. Please let Enid know before early August. She's working away until then. And let me know, let Vice Chair Chapman know, and we'll see what we can do. And I think things will start to ramp up again, as they usually do late in the year and in January, and of course we'll be meeting in February. So lots to do here, and thank you to the MAC staff. Thank you for hosting us. And this part of the meeting is adjourned.
Chairman, can I make formality for a second? We just wanted to flip up one slide for the tour, just to give you a little introduction for the folks that are going to do it. And if you don't mind me breaking formality, I don't have a pointer, so I want to...
We're all kind of... I think we did pretty well without a mic.
For those that are the legislators and staff that are staying for a tour, once we get on the airfield, it can be a little bit confusing out there, so I thought I should lay some groundwork for you so you kind of have a feel for where we're heading. So... give you a feel for the layout here, about 3,300 acres of land. We're going to make our way around the runways and give you a feel for some of the operations. Just really, it's an airport days overview of the airfield. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, there's four different runways. two parallel runways that take up the majority of the traffic most of the time. I kind of call it like a double barrel shotgun because you get the maximum capacity out of these two runways. Whether you're arriving or departing these two runways, you can get a lot of capacity out of them. The other runway, the third runway that gets used the most is 1735 over here, aimed down towards Bloomington up here, Minneapolis on that end. Sometimes people often call it primarily a south-south runway. Because up here, if you're departing or arriving, you would intersect with these two parallels, and now you're affecting the traffic. And so you don't get the northbound or north arrival capacity out of that runway. This is primarily either departing to the south or arriving from the south. Runway 422, our longest runway, the crosswind runway at 11,000 feet, intersects both of these runways all the time. And so because we need that capacity, you really don't use 422 that much. Under times of weather conditions that are so bad that you need to, whether it be wind or thunderstorms, you might be on 422, but you're losing the capacity on these two because you're having to build those gaps in, or when we're doing construction on the airfield. So 422, I think it's less than 2% of our overall capacity, whereas it used to be much higher back in the day when we could kind of build in those gaps. For fun, I'm going to build in these fun stories for you once in a while. The people up in Highland Park in St. Paul oftentimes think they don't get the traffic because of you guys at the Capitol. And so we don't fly over that way, but you guys now understand why 422 doesn't get used as much. But on occasion, when it does, it's the biggest, heaviest airplanes. So when they're coming over Highlands and then things up here, it appears low, and we will get calls instantly to say, what's going on? The traffic patterns change, and it might be for a day because of that. I just wanted to give you a feel for the operation as we work our way around. So we're going to start up here. We came in off of Crosstown, Cedar Avenue over here, and work our way around the field. 494, where most people think of the airport as 494 down there. We'll come around the end of 1735, and we'll kind of go past Terminal 2. We'll swing into Signature, which is where the general aviation's come from. And eventually, we'll come up on, by the terminal building after going through a tunnel here, and we're going to work our way around and talk about some of the operational issues around the airport. Eventually, we're going to stop in a couple of quick facilities, and then we make our way back across the field to an underground tunnel here that goes underneath 422, and we'll kind of sneak us back up here quicker to get back than to get around the first time. I just thought it's good to give you a layout as to where we're going. Otherwise, it can be very confusing on the airfield. So thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.